Hello, and welcome to episode 41 of the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, After Extra Time. By the end of this episode, we'll have dispensed with the 1970s when it comes to the national team, in preparation for a year in 1980 that would be, all in all, rather transformative. And after this episode, we'll be focusing solely on club football until we hit 1980 as well, at which point we're going to take a little pause to reflect and to look forward. And you history buffs will probably be able to guess what particular event is causing me to choose 1980 as a one episode or so stopping point. But back to more pressing matters. In the timeline of our podcast, Yugoslavia is going to host two, arguably three, major international sporting events. One of those, the 1984 Sarajevo Winter Olympics, won't impact upon the timeline at all, given our single sport-focused history. The 1979 Mediterranean Games has a couple of impacts. For one, it was the reason for the construction of Hajduk's Poljud Stadium, and for another, it actually had a football tournament at it, albeit one that only Yugoslavia actually took with any level of seriousness. And they unsurprisingly won the games with consummate ease, with the side that would go to the 1980 Olympics in the USSR. But the first of those major events would be Euro 1976, the final tournament of the 14 format of the Euros that had been used so far. Back then, the tournament hosts were chosen from the sides that had qualified for the semi-finals, and on their third appearance at that stage, Yugoslavia were chosen to host, which, first and foremost, means we have to get them to the tournament. Fortunately, they were handed a relatively kind group against Sweden, Norway, and Northern Ireland. Yugoslavia would win five and lose one of their six games, falling 1-0 to Northern Ireland at Windsor Park in their second group game, but they would qualify with a game to go courtesy of a somewhat lopsided schedule and the other group members taking points from each other. When it came to the quarterfinals, Yugoslavia were given the kind draw also, ending up against Wales. At Maksimir in the first leg, the tone would be set straight away with Muka Vukotic scoring in the first minute after a Popivoda shot from distance was skewed to his feet for him to slot home from the edge of the box, before Popivoda himself scored with a tap-in just before the hour mark to give a 2-0 first leg win. Katalinski would put one away with an early penalty at Ninian Park to secure Yugoslavia's finals place. The finals themselves is of course remembered for containing perhaps the most notable event in the history of penalty taking. No, not an England side losing a penalty shootout for the billionth time. It was the fact that the tournament was won by Czechoslovakia, courtesy of Antonín Panenka showing the world the penalty that would forever bear his name. Alongside the Czechs would be a Dutch side in between their two World Cup finals, and the World Cup holders themselves, West Germany. It was an elite lineup that would be in receipt of a quite bizarre tournament. Unlike in the World Cup in 1974, where the side was picked from Zvezda, Hajduk and Velež to the exclusion of almost everything else, the squad from 1976 came from all over. 10 clubs were represented, with 5 players from outside of Yugoslavia: Hadzijabcic of Charleroi, Jajic at Bastia, Katalinski at Nice, Popivoda at Braunschweig, and Brani Oblak at Schalke. And that foreign contingent was signed that this was an older and apparently wiser cohort of Yugoslav players who had, by and large, been there and done that. The very obvious issue with this format of the tournament was attendances. With the hosts being picked very close to the tournament itself, we can see throughout the history of the four-team format issues with people actually turning out. If we look at Euro 1972, for a very good example, the tournament itself was hosted by Belgium. With the finalists, and therefore the hosts, only confirmed in the month running up to the tournament, there wasn't much time to actually market the tournament, meaning the potential for some quite embarrassing sights, such as a crowd of under 1,700, that's 1,700, I'm not missing an extra zero, turning up to watch the 1972 European Championship semi-final between Hungary and the USSR. It also meant that the third place playoff essentially was reliant solely on walk-up sales because of the nature of the tournament. So, when we mention attendances in relation to Euro 1976, it's worth remembering that much of the blame is related to a format that's going to change, rather than necessarily being a lack of interest. The tournament itself began with Czechoslovakia taking on the Dutch, with Yugoslavia facing West Germany in a major tournament for what feels about the 100th time. Anton Ondrus scored the first for the Czechs, nodding home a free kick before scoring himself at the wrong end in the middle of the second half, sending the tie to extra time. Zdeněk Nihlda would round off a counter-attack and Vaseli would round the keeper to win it late in extra time. Under 18,000 turned up at Maksimir for that game, an attendance likely further hindered by the fact that it was played in torrential rain. When it came to Yugoslavia's semi-final, the hosts began on fire. Popovoda expertly controlled a high through ball and slid home in 19 minutes before Jajic took advantage of a goalkeeping error on a cross to tap in. That would be as good as it got. The Germans pulled one back courtesy of Fluher just after the hour, with a long shot deflecting in, before Gerd Müller rose highest at a corner to equalise and send the tie to extra time. Similarly to the Czechs, the game was decided late. Müller put his side in front after the Yugoslav defence posted missing it across before securing a hat-trick and a final place from a rebound in the last minute of extra time. The result was a third place playoff for Yugoslavia at Maksimir that took place in front of around 6,500 and, wouldn't you know, it ended up going to extra time. But in a reverse of Yugoslavia's semi, the Dutch would be the ones blowing a 2-0 lead this time. Hales would sprint through one-on-one to open the scoring before van der Kerkhove scored from an acute angle. Katalinski got one back before the end of the first half and it would be Zajec who would equalise, putting a free kick into the top corner with aplomb. The winner, when it came, was a carbon copy of the first goal, Hales running through and slotting it under the keeper. The following day, under 31,000 turned out for the final in what seemed a deserted Maracanã to see a dramatic 2-2 draw that would be won courtesy of Uli Hoeneß blazing one penalty over the bar and Antonin Panenka, well, Panenka-ing the winner. It's hard to categorise the tournament itself as a success for Yugoslavia, given both the results and the empty stands. While Yugoslavia had been competitive at all times, they also hadn't won a game. They had a tournament with visible empty stands and provided a reason for UEFA to completely change how they organised the Euros. The attendance issue itself would be sorted come 1984 and did improve in Italy in 1980. Of more import for the tournament was that it represented a changing of the guard, and within a season, Jajic, Katalinski, Maric, Bajevic, Vladic and Oblak were all done at international level. The side that would be in qualifying for the 1978 World Cup was one certain to look radically different to that that played at Euro 1976, and given the names that we've just listed, it's difficult to have seen that as a positive. Manager Ante Mladenić, perhaps seeing the writing on the wall, quit after the Euros with Ivan Toplak taking over. Toplak had managed Sviner Zvezda a decade earlier without success, and had moved to the USA for a decade, winning the indoor NASL, coming back to Yugoslavia to take the job, and the task on his hands was immediate. In his first game, only three players started with more than 10 caps previously, in what was a 3-0 win for Italy. That experience problem would not go away as Yugoslavia travelled to Central America for a winter tour over the winter of 76 and 77, with the nadir being a 5-1 hammering by Mexico over what seemed like a fairly strong Yugoslav lineup. Back in Europe, Toplak would only last one qualifier for the World Cup itself, a home loss to Romania. A selection committee of Marko Valak, Stevan Vilotic and Goko Zek would steer the side through the rest of 1977, one that would include an unsuccessful tour of South America, an absolutely wild 6-4 win over Romania in Bucharest, and a final World Cup qualifier loss to Spain in Belgrade to end the year. They would, however, do one massive positive for the national side. Debut a certain man by the name of Safet Susic. In that game against Romania, Susic's second international game, he would score a hat-trick and set the scene for an international career that would last over a decade through to Italia 90. The management committee had been a period of suffering, a period that would ensure that Yugoslavia would not be travelling to Argentina for the World Cup. But in Safet Susic, they brought into the fold a generational talent who would become as important to the side as Ziyech had been for the previous decade. But more immediately, 1978 would be a poor year again, a year of 4 head coaches and, much like 1977, a year where qualification chances were ended before they began, with the first 2 European qualifiers lost to Spain and Romania. Yugoslavia needed a saviour, and they knew just who to call. As 1979 began, it came with the return to the dugout of Miljan Miljanic. His Yugoslavia side would win every game in 1979, with some banner results and some big introductions into the side. Zlatko Vujovic would get his debut, Blaž Sliskovic would become a regular, and Safet Susic, well, would become a star. 2 mid-year friendlies would yield 2 big wins, the first a 4-1 win over Italy, the second a 4-2 win over the world champions Argentina that served also as Stajic's international retirement. Safet Susic scored a hat-trick in both games. So Yugoslavia would enter the 1980s with nothing to play for, yet no one to fear. In the space of a year, Miljanic had restored the nation back to being one of the most dangerous national teams in world football. It had taken 2 years of pain to get to that point, and Miljanic was the one there to pick up the baton. But, well, it would be a rather short episode were we just to leave it there, and so it gives us an opportunity to take a look in a little depth at one thing we haven't encountered since the start of the 1960s. A defection. Last time, it was Ante Zanetic, and this time, it would be a Hajduk player once again, Savisa Zungul, perhaps known more now as simply Steve Zungul. But his defection would be very different to that of Zanetic. For those who haven't heard the episode in which that was covered, Zanetic's departure was ethnically motivated. A proud Croat, he despaired at what he had seen happen to friends who had embraced nationalism, and had despaired at Hajduk being used as a tool to increase a divide with Dinamo, with their fellow Croats, rather than with what he believed the true enemy, Serbs. Savisa Zungul's defection was less for a cause and more for a life. Zungul, the player at Hajduk, was a bon vivant, much like a George Best. Prolific on the pitch and bohemian off it, regularly seen in bars and regularly seen with a model type on his shoulder. In 6 years at the club, he had become a regular component of the national team and carried a reputation long beyond Yugoslavia's borders. Yet, all was not well behind the scenes. Hajduk owed him money, and Zungul suspected that Hajduk were on the brink of ordering him to go on his 18-month-long military service just to buy time for them to scrabble together the cash to pay him what he was already due. It was an atmosphere of mutual mistrust, particularly as Zungul and then manager Tomislav Savivic didn't see eye to eye, as Zungul wanted to be able to play with more freedom than a structured manager like Ivic would ever allow. Come the winter break in the 1978-79 season, Zungul played in the last game before the close and scored a double. After the match, he approached club management and asked to be allowed to go for a trip to New York City. This didn't actually raise any suspicions. Zungul's partner at the time was a US-based Slovenia singer, Moni Kovacic, and he stated he'd play a couple of indoor games while in the US so as to stay match fit for when he came back. It all seemed very reasonable, and Hyduk accepted. Except, that wasn't the real story. Having US contacts already, Zungle had gotten in contact with Dragan Popovic, formerly a Hyduk player in the mid-60s, and someone who had been in North America for a decade, managing in Canada and in the NASL. Popovic had set up the team Zungle proposed to keep match fit for, the New York Arrows, and as a former Hyduk player himself, he had used his connections to make sure he got this man. When Zungle got to the USA and the Arrows announced him, not as a guest but as their new signing, Hyduk realised they'd been had. Unlike Anzis Netic, who was more or less wiped from history, Zungle found himself instead as front page news, with a smear campaign against him organised by Hyduk. They lobbied the FA to lobby FIFA and get Zungle banned for deserting his contract, and this effort would be successful. At just 24, he would not be permitted to play in any FIFA-affiliated league, essentially a ban on football on grass, for over 4 years. With it taking a US Supreme Court decision overturning a wider ban on indoor players playing outdoors to permit him to do so. With such a history behind him already, Zungle would, unsurprisingly, go on to be the greatest player in the history of US indoor soccer, a wild six-a-side arena game that he, a Yugoslav international and legitimately top-class striker, had absolutely no business playing in. In his time at the Arrows, he scored 372 goals in 145 games. And no, I've not got those numbers the wrong way round. He eventually left as his six-figure salary was bankrupting the Arrows, and on returning to outdoor football for the Golden Bay Earthquakes, who also played indoor, he won the MVP award for the NASL. During one indoor season, he scored 108 goals in 40 appearances, more than doubling the record of his nearest rival. Now, it is worth stating that Zungle was hardly the only Yugoslav player who went to indoor football and to America. There was even an extensive list of players who had been born in Yugoslavia playing for the USA, such as Boris Bandov, Mark Liverich, Fred Gugurev, George and Louis Nanchov, and Werner Roth. Zungle was merely the most famous and the most controversial of the lot, albeit Werner Roth would gain his own fame by playing the captain of the Nazi team in Escape to Victory. Zungle would eclipse them all, taking to the high life in America as he did in Yugoslavia, long after his hairline had deserted him. He danced after scoring and became known as Disco Steve. To some, he was simply the Babe Ruth or the Wayne Gretzky of indoor soccer, with six MVP awards, being its leading goal scorer of all time by 200 goals, and its leading assist creator of all time by over 100. But while you could feasibly do a couple of episodes on Zungle's career alone, he certainly is an interesting fellow, it must be brought back to its relevance to this one. Zungle left Yugoslavia to be free. Where players had left for money before, they were only allowed to do so come their late 20s. Where Zanetic left because of old battles, Zungle left because of ones to come. A player's right to decide for whom he plays, a younger generation's right to live a life with fewer restrictions than what Yugoslavia allowed, a love of a brighter life than Split or Zagreb or Belgrade could provide. Zungle's departure came just as the Yugoslav success story began to falter. Next time on the podcast. Well, we may be out of the 70s when it comes to the national team, but there's still a little way to go on the domestic scene after Hyduk had lost the title so controversially in our last episode. In our next one, it's time for Belgrade to take back control. Thank you for listening, and I'll catch you next time.